I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The seismographs across Asia and the Pacific registered new aftershocks today in the wake of yesterday's major quake, which was centered off the western coast of Indonesia and registered 8.7 on the Richter scale. Joining us from Jakarta is Tom McCauley of the Christian Science Monitor. And Tom, what updated information do you have at this point as to the damage, the injuries, or the death toll from yesterday's earthquake?
Well, typically, the first few days after one of these major events is days of uncertainty and waiting. The president's spokesman today said that police and military are still making preliminary assessments. Communications are still there, but the casualty figure is fluctuating from 1,000 to 2,000 at the moment, expected to rise. Much of the infrastructure has been damaged on the islands affected. Again, we just don't know how bad the damage is because a lot of this had been damaged by the earthquake in December. So it's a really awful period of waiting.
Right. Well, we understand two islands near the epicenter of yesterday's quake were especially hard hit. One called Simulu reportedly may have been hit by a 9-foot tsunami. Red Cross officials say they've had no contact with their staff there. Have you heard anything more? I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is part of the problem. I've heard reports variously of a 10-inch tsunami, a 3-foot tsunami, nothing in the realm of 9 feet, except possibly in parts of Australia. But you see, this is part of the problem. The reports are only just now starting to flow back.
Well, yesterday's quake, Tom, comes 3 months after the disastrous huge tsunami, as we said. So were people better prepared this time around?
The people were much better prepared in that they've had absolutely saturation media coverage of the tsunami. They've been warned repeatedly. The events have been replayed over and over again on television screens and newspaper. This is now a very tsunami-literate society. Bear in mind, a lot of people didn't know what the word meant before December the 26th. And so this awareness was reflected in the reaction after the earthquake, a very simple reaction, and that reaction was to pack up and leave quickly, to flee, to go to a higher area. Now, that simple act alone would have saved tens of thousands of lives back in December.
Well, Tom, I'm just wondering, after yesterday's earthquake, today's aftershock, how are people feeling? I'm imagining nerves are on edge.
People are very jittery. People in Bali actually told me that it was a flashback, that they momentarily relived what they went through on that hellish night of December the 26th.
Tom McCauley, a stringer for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Jakarta, Indonesia. Tom, thank you as always.
Again, thanks a lot. All the best. Bye-bye.
Well, jitters are understandable. And we turn now to Kostas Sinulaikas, a professor of civil engineering at the University of Southern California. He also heads the USC Tsunami Research Group and joins us from Los Angeles. Professor, can you tell us, first of all, was yesterday's quake expected?
Yes, indeed. Yesterday's quake was expected. It was not expected this soon. There was, in fact, only in the last 15 days, a paper in Nature that was predicting increased seismic activity in the part of the fault that ruptured.
And is the stress because of the last huge earthquake?
Yes. Because you see, one plate moves and it sort of pushes the other, and, you know, in layman's terms, stress accumulates.
Yeah. Well, then, as you know, we're hearing all sorts of reports of a tsunami surge following yesterday's quake, anywhere from 10 inches to 9 feet. What is your sense of the fallout?
Well, certainly we had much less fallout than the December 26th event. I think we still have to find out what is the fallout in close to the generation region near the epicenter. But what is really confusing is that this is, if you will, a rupture zone that ruptures almost adjacent to the rupture zone December 26th. Sure enough, it is much smaller rupture, but nonetheless, the tsunami is smaller than we expected.
We understand that the effect of yesterday's earthquake, whatever wave there was, went west and not east, and that was perplexing.
If indeed it didn't go east, I mean, this evening, U.S. time, I mean, and we're going to have the first reports from professionals, I would seriously doubt it that there was no tsunami going to the east. It may well have been that the tsunami to the east was a depression wave, means that it caused the shore line to retreat and then come back, and that was not really noticed because it was at night. But we will have to see.
Right, because in the dark it's impossible to see
exactly,
a smaller
exactly.
wave.
And this was our greatest fear with this quake, that it was going to hit most of the in the countries in the Indian Ocean in the dark. And this is why they had to be prepared.
You know, and some might say, Professor, that there should be a detection system, that we shouldn't have to not be able to see in the dark. The conference you attended in Paris was organized just for that, to develop an Indian Ocean tsunami warning system, such as
Indeed,
the one.
It was a conference organized by UNESCO, but again, there was no emphasis on what we need, which is direct tsunami detection. We need to be able to detect if a tsunami was generated. What we have right now is seismometers, which are these instruments that detect earthquakes. But as we found out, earthquake detection does not necessarily mean, you know, tsunami detection. I mean, it was very frustrating as the day was progressing yesterday to have to call different people around the Indian Ocean to try to have, you know, early reports, the tsunami arrived, how big it was. And in this day and age, I mean, we have the technology, it exists in the North Pacific. And this is exactly what we need in the Indian Ocean to be able to do tsunami forecasting and have more focused warnings.
But Professor, there are others who say that, in fact, the best system for a poor, underdeveloped country is perhaps a low-tech system, an understanding that when there's an earthquake, just run.
Absolutely. Public education works, and we've been advocating that. But there are some barriers, for example, like in Banda Aceh, where the tsunami inundated up to 2 miles inland. It would take a person, 20 minutes to run 2 miles inland if they're sitting on the ground. But I absolutely agree with you. The best warning system is the personal warning system. You know what to do, and if you feel the ground shake or if you see any unusual water motion, you just move inland or to high ground.
Mm. Kostas Sinoulakis heads the Tsunami Research Group at the University of Southern California. He spoke to us from Los Angeles. Professor Sinoulakis, thanks very much.
Have a good afternoon and good evening.
At the request of her parents, the Reverend Jessie Jackson attempted to visit Terry Schiavo in her hospice room today, but Michael Schiavo, her husband, wouldn't let him, this according to Associated Press. The brain-damaged Florida woman is now in her 12th day without food or water and is expected to soon die. Her case has raised a lot of questions, not the least of which the one many are asking themselves. Should I have a living will? Well, do you have one?
No. No living will at all. Not now. I don't think I need one yet. Give me 20 years. Maybe I'll decide to get one then.
Do you have a living will?
Yes, I do. We, my husband and I both drew them up when we had our kids.
No, but I'm only 18.
No, too lazy.
You know, I don't yet, and I should. I had one at one time, and I never filled it out. And you know, I think I still have it buried somewhere with my mail, and I'd better go get it out.
The thoughts of some people we spoke with in Boston about living wills. Well, Terry Schiavo did not have one. Her husband, Michael Schiavo, said his wife expressed her wishes about end of life verbally, but her parents disagree with his memory. Now, as a result of their case, lawmakers are considering amending laws on living wills. Over the past month alone, lawmakers in 13 states introduced bills to change the end of life health care laws, in some cases to put the decision in the hands of judges. Well, joining us on the phone from Washington is Dr. Joanne Lynn. She's a geriatrician and researcher at the RAND Corporation and the author of The Handbook for Mortals and many other publications on end-of-life issues. Welcome.
I'm glad to be with you.
Are the laws regarding living wills the same across the country?
Oh, no. They vary substantially. Not that that matters much. The practices are even more varied than the laws are.
Oh, joy. Okay, well, we'll get a little deeper into that in a moment, as if it's not, you know, hard enough to even think about this for a lot of people. Well, do you have a living will?
Oh, yes. I have a very unusual living will. Mine says that I have more of a priority that my family can live with their decisions and that I want my health care providers to go along with anything that my family directs them to do, and specifically not to use things I've written or spoken about as evidence of what I would prefer. And I don't want some doctor telling my husband that because he's read my book, he knows me better than my husband does.
Well, yeah, you do have a particular concern, I guess. But when you say your husband, that was going to be my next question. Family, as we've found out with the Schiavo case, is a very tricky word. Do you have to be more specific than that?
Well, that's. It would be good to name specific people when you can. Sometimes, especially older ladies, are very reticent to pick among their children. I don't think that people have to pick one among a group, but it's better if you can. Mostly, families, though, do come together. I mean, mostly it's not a question of who has the legal authority, because mostly everybody wants to try to find a way of moving forward that seems all right.
Do living wills always trump any kind of state law? I'm thinking of the Schiavo case. If, for instance, Terry Schiavo had left a living will instructing that her parents decide what her end-of-life care would be, would that trump the laws, which we've been understanding, decide that the spouse...
Well, no, in Schiavo's situation, actually, what mattered was the evidence as to what she would have wanted, which was, in this particular instance, presented mostly by her husband.
Yeah, in other words, if the parents had said, oh, no, no, we heard her say this, we heard her say this, then it would be an even more intense battle, I would think.
Sure, and that's why we have courts, because the courts have to weigh these things and figure out what is the best understanding. Sometimes the courts are given a direction of bias. In New York State and Missouri, you have to have clear and convincing evidence before you could stop a treatment. So the standards vary a little bit from state to state.
In states that don't have that requirement, and when there is no living will, how is end of life decided?
Mostly turning to the family and trusting that their values are very close to the patient's.
You've said that in some of these states, which are tougher, if a patient hasn't spoken of his or her wishes and there's no living will, instead of the family deciding, a judge does?
Yeah. You have to go to court.
Which states are they?
Well, in New York, for example. If what you want to do is to stop a feeding tube and there's no written directive on the matter, then it has to be reviewed. Whereas in North Carolina, there's a list of who can make decisions that obviously starts with the closest family, but at the end of the list is your doctor. So if you don't have anybody else, they actually trust the doctor.
So it's really important for people to check their state law if they're on at all on the fence about this.
Yeah, and every state does have a statement of its law. They sometimes can take a little work to get them. Usually your hospital association or your medical association can make it available to you, but they can be quite complicated. And then, of course, there are the local practices where a nursing home or a hospital decides that for their own protection, they're going to require just a little more conservative interpretation than the law absolutely requires, which means more hoops for the family to jump.
Dr. Joanne Lynn, geriatrician and researcher at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. Well, when we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the living will forms that are available online. They range from one-page forms to entire booklets with essay sections. We'll take a look at them. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation on the law and the paperwork surrounding end-of-life decision-making, as we were just discussing, laws vary from state to state on who can make what decisions based on what evidence. But there is a lot of help on the Internet for families and patients facing these complicated choices, and also help for anyone else who doesn't have those choices yet but also doesn't have a living will and wants to get prepared. I have some printed samples in front of me. We're speaking with Dr. Joanne Lynn, who is a geriatrician and researcher at the RAND Corporation. She's also the author of The Handbook for Mortals and a lot of other publications on end-of-life issues. And Dr. Lynn, for instance, I have here the group Aging with Dignity puts out a booklet called The 5 Wishes for End-of-Life Care.
Sure.
You're familiar with it. The 5 wishes are the person I want to make care decisions for me when I can't, the kind of medical treatment I want or don't want, how comfortable I want to be, how I want people to treat me, and what I want my loved ones to know. And as I said, it's a booklet, and it walks you through it. It's only recognized in 36 states, but what do you think of it?
It's a very comprehensive form. It appeals to people who enjoy reflecting on these issues and who are reasonably verbal and like to, a lot of it requires writing short answers. Some people find it annoying because it seems to require a sense of closure that they might not feel. But nevertheless, it's of use. I think that an awful lot of people who are elderly and sick find it way too daunting.
Well, the Five Wishes sort of booklet is about $5. The price goes down if you order more than one copy. Give it to all your friends. I said it's only recognized in 36 states. Why?
Well, some states require some odd pieces, like the extra things that the New York state law requires. Some require a specific format for notarization, for example, or something like that. Usually, if you fill out the Five Wishes form, even if it isn't, strictly speaking, enforced within your state's law, it would be so profoundly persuasive that it would, in fact, carry the day. So, yeah, it's a good form. But there are others. There are shorter ones. There's a form called the Medical Directive that the American Medical Association has endorsed. There's the Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
I have that in front of me. That's the Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or PULSED. That is just 2 pages, and it looks very straightforward, as if you were filling out, you know, to get your driver's license. It asks about CPR, if you want that, if you want medical interventions, comfort measures only, or additional interventions, antibiotics, and you get to say whether or not you want it.
And some space for some free form that gives some other advice. Remember, this is a physician's order, so it's legitimate for a doctor to fill in the basic circumstance of the patient, the contact information, but it's a very straightforward form that is sufficient to keep the emergency medical services from putting you on a ventilator or, in that sort of way, really fouling up your care plan.
Right. I'm also holding another form from the conservative group, the National Right to Life. It, in addition to offering people options for what they want, it says the reason to do it is there's a pro-euthanasia view widespread in society. There's a great danger that what you do will be misunderstood. Many in the medical profession, as well in the courts, are now so committed to the equality of life ethic that they take as a given that patients with severe disabilities are better off dead. It certainly is quite politicized.
Yes, it
to
is.
To put it mildly.
And, you know, a person who has really thought it through and thinks this is correct should sign such a form. I mean, a Pulse can say that. A Five Wishes can say that. But if you sign a form that says that you want every last thing done to delay the moment of your dying, no matter what it puts you through and no matter what the costs, this is not a trivial choice. So be careful. The politics of it may sound terribly appealing, but when you think about being 94 years old and with a very bad stroke and really coming to the end of your life, how much would you want to go through to die tomorrow instead of tonight?
But as you said, there are people for whom this would be very comforting, being able to fill out a form, the Will to Live from the National Right to Life organization, that would ensure that they would not have their feeding tube removed, for instance.
Exactly.
And we should say, you like the Vermont Ethics Network form, which I have in front of me. It's the Vermont Advanced Directive for Healthcare, prepared by the Vermont Ethics Network. And why do you like that?
I think it's a nice balance. There are a lot of people who find it comfortable to fill out a form of that sort of intermediate size. It's not quite as daunting. I think the Five Wishes is, 13 pages long or something like that?
Yeah.
It's a booklet.
Well, Dr. Lynn, we've now gotten to the lightning round portion, so I'm just going to ask you a whole series of questions that people have. If you could just give us the brief answers, we'll take notes. How's that?
Okay.
Do you have to have an attorney to make out a living will?
Not at all.
Do you have to even have a form? Can you just write a letter? No?
In most states, it's quite legal to use as an advance directive a handwritten letter to your son.
Huh.
I mean, anything that gives evidence. In fact, even verbal statements have weight in almost all states.
As we've just seen. And that's the next question. What if your family or loved one can't find your advance directive or living will? The verbal counts?
Oh, yes.
How about if you fill out the Vermont living will and then move to California?
In almost all circumstances, any evidence of what the patient truly wanted will be persuasive.
Yeah. One question you say has been posed to you. My parent had a living will, but the doctor ignored it. Can that happen?
Usually, I mean, it does happen, of course.
Oh, but that's a mistake. That's not legal or correct?
Well, no, but most of the time what really happened is the patient had a standard old-fashioned living will that says something like, when it's clear that I'm going to die anyway, then don't use artificial means to delay my dying. Almost every word in the sentence requires definition in the context of a person who's very sick. So it isn't usually that it's ignored. It's usually that it doesn't say enough to know what the person was trying to say.
Right.
So you need, as you get older and sicker, to be more specific. You need to say, you know, I understand that I have emphysema. I've been on a ventilator twice, but I wouldn't want to spend all the rest of my days on it. So try it for up to a week. But if it looks like you can't get me off within a week, then for heaven's sake, sedate me and let me go. Something that specific is almost always followed.
Dr. Joanne Lin, a geriatrician and researcher at the RAND Corporation. For more on living wills, go to our website, here-now.org. And tomorrow on Here and Now, schools in a race to get the big-name professors, the big exercise facilities. Is that a good education? That's tomorrow. And there's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In his budget plan for next fiscal year, President Bush has proposed cutting all federal funding for the nation's largest passenger railroad system, Amtrak. The railroad has lost money every year since it was created in 1971 and has been given more than $25 billion in federal subsidies in that time. The White House says its strategy is to force Amtrak into bankruptcy and that hopefully the Amtrak will come out of the other side as a leaner and more efficient operation. White House officials are also counting on states and the private sector to take over Amtrak's business. David Nice is a professor of political science at Washington State University and the author of Amtrak, The History and Politics of a National Railroad. He spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Professor, let me ask you a question that I think many people in Congress are asking at this moment, and many people in Washington in general. Why can't Amtrak turn a profit on its own?
Well, a lot of reasons, but one big one is that we have very big government subsidies for our highway system, which is a big competitor for Amtrak, and very big subsidies for the aviation industry, which is their other main competitor. So we sort of single out Amtrak and also urban mass transit and say, why can't you operate at a profit? But we subsidize the highway program. We don't ask it to turn a profit. And the air transport industry, in effect, we don't ask it to turn a profit. The subsidies there are more hidden, but the big thing is its competition is subsidized.
Respond to someone who might say, though, if the railroad can't turn a profit, isn't it evidence that rail passenger service isn't necessary? I mean, when airlines can't turn a profit, they go bankrupt and some go belly up.
Actually, most of them don't. Most of them get rescued. Plus, we've had all sorts of subsidies that have helped to make the aviation industry what it is today. Did they spend the money for the research to develop new aircraft technologies? Mostly no. Mostly that's the federal government spending it. And if you go back to September 11th, all of the airlines were in big financial trouble. Did we stand by and say, we'll let all of them go broke? No, we had very quickly a $20 billion bailout zooms through Congress, many times what Amtrak got that year.
But come to the point, if you would, if you think that rail service is necessary in the way we're running it now.
I think it is, and it's going to get more necessary. We've got a couple of time bombs in our transportation system, one of which just got noticed a little more yesterday with the letter to President Bush from a number of former national security personnel at high ranks. One time bomb is the dependence on imported oil, which is gradually growing. And our two major passenger modes, cars and airplanes, have very big appetites for oil. We're going to have to do something about our transportation system's oil appetite. And of our major transportation modes, the railroads, both for passengers and freight, are the best suited to converting to operating without oil with current technologies. The other reason is that our population is gradually getting older. And as people get older, especially for men, look at the highway accident statistics, older drivers start having vision problems, hearing problems, orthopedic problems that make them more and more dangerous. But if you take their licenses away, they can't drive. We're going to have to think about retailing our transportation system to an older population, and Amtrak is very well adapted to that.
Let's talk about the president's plan. The Bush administration has proposed turning over some of Amtrak's equipment and property over to the states and turning quite a bit of the responsibility of funding the cost of Amtrak over to state governments. In your opinion, how will that affect the operation?
It will mean most of the long-distance trains will disappear because the efforts in the past when more than one state's tried to go together to support an Amtrak train, it hasn't worked out for any length of time. So what you'll end up with are little clusters of relatively localized service and nothing else.
Would that be a bad thing?
Yeah, I think it would, because it greatly undercuts the options of the traveling public. And it means that the states that aren't located around a big city like Chicago or Los Angeles will probably end up with nothing at all. We've gone through a period of reduced air travel service and reduced bus service to many of our medium-sized and smaller communities all over the country. And so if you take out Amtrak, a lot of communities would have no public transportation of any kind.
Do you think this proposal is going to fly? Certainly, there's already a tremendous opposition in some of the states where Amtrak runs, and there's opposition one would expect in Congress and on the Amtrak board.
Yes, and the general public. We know from public opinion surveys, most Americans want to have an intercity passenger rail service, and most Americans are willing to see it subsidized. So, you know, in a way, we've got another example of those Washington, D.C. sorts of political hubbubs, if you will. I think we'll see plenty of mobilization against the Bush program, and it's already starting.
So, again, do you think the Bush plan will fail?
Yes. And I think that in terms of the interests of the country, it'd be a good thing for it to fail. I mean, if you want to jump from one policy arena to another, to say that the federal government has no interest in whether we have a national passenger rail system, but yet the national government should jump into the end-of-life decisions for Terry Schiavo, that's a really large sort of inconsistency as far as I can tell.
But let me ask you about the future of Amtrak from your opinion. The Bush administration says that it thinks that Amtrak needs to change or it needs to die. The federal government simply can't keep subsidizing Amtrak to the tune of $1.2 billion or more a year.
Well, actually, it can. I mean, we spend money on all sorts of things, and we certainly can't afford to spend that much on the system. We spend a heck of a lot more on a lot of other things, some of which might surprise people. I think it does need to change. I think we need to look at more frequent service. I think we need to try to restore some of the routes in the western part of the country that we lost over the years due to budget crises. And one other thing that Amtrak really needs, which is not much of the debate as far as I've heard so far, we need to have a much more regular system of equipment replacement, because anybody that runs any kind of a business will tell you, you need to have a regular schedule of replacing things as they get worn out, not keeping them running until the day comes if and when you get some money for some replacements, and so you're running with equipment that really should have been retired before now.
So, Professor, what you're saying is Amtrak ain't as broke as the administration thinks.
That's absolutely right.
Professor David Nice, thank you very much.
Okay.
David Nice is a political science professor at Washington State University and the author of Amtrak, The History and Politics of a National Railroad. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. Still to come, Gene Wilder on, among other things, his old compulsion to pray. You're listening to Here and Now. a convicted murderer and rapist in Colorado, will be spared the death penalty because the jury consulted the Bible while deciding his fate. In a 3-2 decision, the Colorado Supreme Court yesterday upheld a lower court's ruling to throw out the death sentence against 40-year-old Robert Harlan. Harlan had been sentenced to death in 1995 for the kidnap, rape, and murder of 25-year-old Rhonda Maloney. He was also convicted of shooting and paralyzing another woman who tried to help the victim escape. Well, joining us on the line to talk about this case is Ronald Chen, an associate dean of the Rutgers School of Law in Newark, New Jersey. Dean Chen, welcome.
Thank you.
And also Alicia Caldwell, who's covering the case for the Denver Post. And Alicia, I want to start with you. How did this jury consult the Bible? Did they bring it in the jury room?
Yes, they did. They began deliberating on a Friday afternoon and quickly realized, I'm told, that one juror had some problems with his Christian faith, whether administering the death penalty would violate the tenets of that. The jurors went back to their hotel rooms on Saturday, looked at Bibles, made indices of what passages might help him overcome that and apply the death penalty. They went back in the jury room, read some passages, including that passage from Leviticus, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And by noon, they had a death penalty.
And this is a case that was followed closely in Colorado. It's pretty gruesome. In 1994, Rhonda Maloney was on her way home from her job as a cocktail waitress. Harlan ran her off the road, raped her at gunpoint. After 2 hours, she got away from him. And that's when a Good Samaritan came along?
That's right. Yes, Jackie Creazzo was driving along a highway and sees the struggling woman, stops to help. Harlan comes charging up, shoots her, and ultimately paralyzes her. Harlan, who's a son of a Denver police detective, then snatches Maloney and takes off with her, which set off a frenzy of search activity in Denver. They found her body beaten with a bullet hole in her forehead a week later.
And the Good Samaritan paralyzed for life. Dean Chen, what's the law here? Are you not allowed to bring faith into jury decisions?
Well, no, actually, jurors are expected to bring all their life experiences, including their spiritual religious background, with them in order to decide the case. And I think the majority made clear they were not saying that jurors could not use religion in their deliberations or even talk about it. It seems to be what the majority was basing its decision on was the fact that the Bible itself was physically brought into the jury room, which is against normal rules of procedure that only matters that have been introduced into evidence by the judge, been admitted into evidence by the judge, can be viewed by the jury.
So I want to get this straight. So in other words, if the jurors had just pointed to Leviticus and just said from memory, well, what about the passage in Leviticus, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, in trying to convince this other juror to go with the death penalty, that would not have been objectionable?
Well, what the majority apparently believed is that the power of the written word, a physical presence, a Bible in the room, is qualitatively more powerful than the spoken word. When a juror started bringing in extraneous material, like the Bible, and started quoting from it, that gives a greater ring of authority, and jurors are not supposed to go out and try to find facts, find evidence on their own.
Well, Alicia, how have the family members of murder victim Rhonda Maloney responded?
Well, I talked yesterday to Bob Grant, who was the lead prosecutor on the case as the DA in Adams County, and he said they range from being disturbed to greatly upset by the ruling. Mm-hmm. We talked to Jackie Creazzo yesterday. She always had some misgivings about the death penalty and frankly, is okay with this.
We understand that the woman who brought the Bible in the first place is now saying that she thinks that overturning the death penalty is now God's will. But Dean Chen, is there a chance for an appeal, a chance that the death penalty could be reimposed?
That would go to the U.S. Supreme Court, so the prosecutors would have to try to raise an issue of federal constitutional law. I myself think that's somewhat unlikely. It appears in this case that the Colorado Supreme Court was applying Colorado criminal procedure, and I think it's a little unlikely the U.S. Supreme Court is going to intervene.
Ronald Chen, an associate dean at the Rutgers School of Law, Alicia Caldwell, reporter for the Denver Post, speaking about the case in Colorado, a death penalty conviction overturned because the jurors consulted a Bible. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Jerry Silberman was the son of Jewish-Russian immigrants in Milwaukee. When he was 8, his mom had a heart attack, and the doctor told him, "Don't argue with your mother. You could kill her. And always try to make her laugh." When he was 11, he saw his sister on stage and decided that was the closest thing to God. And so a soft-spoken, funny actor who worshipped the theater was born. As Gene Wilder, he would star in a dozen stage productions and 25 films, including his role as the original Leo Bloom in the Mel Brooks classic, The Producers.
I want everything I've ever seen in the movies!
Leo, say you'll join me! I'll do it!
As a young man, Gene Wilder suffered from what he called the demon, an inexplicable compulsion to pray. But he would later write the film that featured one of the funniest monsters on celluloid, Young Frankenstein.
He is as gentle as a lamb. Stand back! Stand back! For the love of God, he has a rotten brain!
Gene Wilder's new memoir is entitled Kiss Me Like a Stranger, and he joins us in the studio. Hello.
Thank you.
And I should mention that your longtime therapist is also featured in your new book. So I'm wondering, am I the first one to draw a line from this childhood demon to Frankenstein?
You are the first.
What do you think?
I don't understand it, but...
I thought it could be some sort of exorcism.
No. It was too painful. It was in my freshman year at the University of Iowa. And I had this compulsion to pray, first 15 minutes, then a half an hour, an hour. When it went on for 6 or 7 hours in a row, I didn't think of it as anything holy, and I didn't think it had anything to do with God. I thought it was a horror. And it took 7.5 years of therapy for me to understand that how did I have the right to be happy when my mother was suffering every day of her life. So whenever I started to get happy, the compulsion would come in, and I'd start to pray, and it ruined whatever I was doing at the time. Mm-hmm. The only time I felt safe was on stage. They or she or he couldn't get me.
And he eventually went away for good.
Oh, but that was 10 years later.
Yeah. How weird.
Yeah.
To have that. Well, I'm going to fast you forward because you're on stage.
I'm going to fast forward you.
All right, whatever.
Fast you. I'm going on a fast, and I don't want to go on a fast yet.
We're
going to
move into the future. You're on stage in New York performing in a Jerome Robbins production of Mother Courage, starring Anne Bancroft.
Anne Bancroft's boyfriend was Mel Brooks, and that changed my life probably more than any other thing that happened to me in my early life.
Yeah. Him you liked.
Oh, always, immediately.
When you hear a character like Leo Bloom that was, you know, you fit it like a glove, what do you think now?
I don't watch myself in the movies.
You don't?
No.
I mean, why would you?
Once in a while, Young Frankenstein. Once in a while.
Because?
Because I always say I could have done that so much better.
What? It was a perfect movie. How did you come up with the idea?
I took out a yellow legal pad and a blue felt pen. And I wrote at the top, Young Frankenstein. And then I jotted down 2 pages of what I thought might happen to me if I were told that I inherited the estate of my great-grandfather, Beaufort von Frankenstein, but I had to come to Transylvania to collect it and so on. And that was it.
You write that it was one of the happiest times you've ever had making that movie. And yet one of the greatest scenes from the movie almost didn't get in because Mel didn't like it originally?
Almost. When he read Puttin' on the Ritz, he said, are you nuts? You can't just suddenly start tap dancing with the monster and so on. And I argued for about 20, 25 minutes till I was red in the face. He said, okay, it's in. And that's the only argument we ever had.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
Now that still makes me laugh. That makes me laugh. That still
I'm remembering when we did it too and how funny it was when we actually... To hear Peter Boyle saying... it broke me up all the time. At first it was too tough. I couldn't do it without laughing.
You know, in the book... you're very honest. The subtitle of the book is My Search for Love and Art.
Yeah.
And so along the way, we hear about your 4 marriages. And the one that you know that people are most aware of is the one to the late Gilda Radner. You write, she's the most extraordinary person you ever met, a firefly who glowed in the dark and in the light, but also was bulimic, needy. How difficult was that for you to tell people about what they thought was a storybook romance?
Well, I know it would come as a big surprise. I loved her, and that was a fact. And she drove me crazy at times, and that was a fact. But drove me crazy because she was so needy. Then at the bulimia, she licked it, and it's very hard to lick. But she did lick it, and when she licked it, she got cancer, stage 4 ovarian cancer. And then when she was desperately ill, she treated everyone, every stranger she met, with kindness, no matter how much she was suffering, but not me.
Well, a year after Gilda died in 1989, you fell in love with your current wife. But you write you couldn't tell anyone how happy you were or even feel it yourself because everyone still pictured you with Gilda. Again, you have your own therapist, but for the second time...
I had.
For the second time in your life, here you are wanting to be happy, but because of a very sick, beloved woman in your life...
You made the connection there,
sister. You don't want to
You mean you're talking about my mother?
Yeah, and then Gilda.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I was grateful that people were touched, remembering her, how much they cared about her, cared about me, but mostly about her and how sad it must be for me.
And it was. Of course, at the time it was.
But after a year had passed, and I had met Karen and realized how right we were for each other and how much I loved her, I wanted to marry, but I didn't want the tabloids to start, he waits one year and he's off and running with another woman and all that stuff.
Well, you say that Gilda gave you many gifts. One of them, the title of your new book, Kiss Me Like a Stranger, was her suggestion for a title years ago because of the way you felt she treated strangers. And silly me, I thought it was about us. Can we share our story?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, you tell it.
Okay, well, there we are. And see if I've got it right.
Yeah.
There we are in the 70s. You are promoting your film, The World's Greatest Lover, your sort of take on Valentino. And I'm interviewing you, and you are flinging me around with faux kisses. We're getting into the role. Fast forward 20 years after that, and I saw you walking through an airport, and you had a pork pie hat on and a sort of a beige khaki suit. You had 2 leather valises, 1 in each hand, and you were striding through the airport. And I thought, oh, I've got just a second to talk to him. And I ran up alongside you, fell in step with you, and said, Mr. Wilder, you kissed me once in Boston.
And you said, the last time I saw you, you kissed me in Boston.
And you said what?
You don't call, you don't write. What kind of a relationship is this?
You never looked up, you never broke stride. Gene Wilder, the name of the book is Kiss Me Like a Stranger, My Search for Love and Art. Thank you.
Thank you.
Try mighty hard to look like Gary Cooper.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here Now.
Putting on the Ritz does make me laugh. I think when Marty and I were pushing the casket down this cobblestone street and it crashed and the monster's arm fell out, and then the constable comes and says, need a hand? I said, no thanks, have one, and I start to pretend that the monster's hand is my hand. That makes me laugh. Cora Sleepshin probably made me laugh more in that film than anyone else.
You mean he? No. Yes.
Yeah. He was my boyfriend.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.